These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you can learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The Long Shadow of the Ancient Greek World, Part 1. Ian Worthington is Frederick A. Middlebush Professor of History at the University of Missouri, Columbia. He was born in England in 1958 and received his B.A. in Classical Studies from the University of Hull and his M.A. in Ancient History from the University of Durham, where he wrote a thesis on the Pisistratid tyranny at Athens. He went to Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, to write a thesis on the Greek orator Dionarchus and Athenian history in the age of Alexander the Great for his Ph.D., which he received in 1987. After Monash, he taught for 10 years in the classics departments at the University of New England and the University of Tasmania in Australia, before moving to Missouri in 1998. Professor Worthington has published 14 sole-authored and edited books and more than 80 articles on Greek history, epigraphy, and oratory, including the biographies Alexander the Great, Man and God, and Philip II of Macedonia, as well as the Blackwell Companion to Greek Rhetoric. He is currently writing a biography of Demosthenes, editing the Blackwell Companion to Ancient Macedonia, and serving as editor-in-chief of Brill's New Jacobi, a new edition of 856 fragmentary works by ancient Greek historians involving a team of 112 scholars in 16 countries. Professor Worthington has given various newspaper, radio, and television interviews and also founded the Biennial Orality and Literacy in Ancient Greece Conference Series and the Biennial Fordyce Mitchell Memorial Lecture Series held in his department at the University of Missouri, Columbia. In 2005, he won the Chancellor's Award for Outstanding Research and Creativity in the Humanities. And in 2007, he won the Student Athlete Advisory Council Most Inspiring Professor Award. Professor Worthington prepared the course guidebook that comes with these lectures. The guidebook includes an outline for each lecture, a timeline, a glossary, biographical notes, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to review these materials before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. Three Mainstays of Ancient Greece.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, and welcome to the ancient Greek world. I'm very glad indeed you decided to choose this course, and I hope you enjoy it. That's certainly my aim, is to make you enjoy it. My name is Ian Worthington, and I teach Greek history at the University of Missouri-Columbia in Columbia, Missouri. You will have spotted an accent already, I'm sure, and this is the product of me being born and raised in northern England, close to Manchester, if you know that part of the world, then moving to Australia, where I lived for 15 years, until the last big move to Missouri in 1998. By now, I think most traces of an English or Australian accent have pretty much gone, but then again, I know the vowels still give me away, so I'm hoping you'll pick up on my accent before too long. In the first part of this lecture, I'm going to talk about why ancient Greece is important for us, what this course is about, and how I've organized the 48 lectures in it. In the second part, we're going to look at aspects of what modern historians call the Bronze Age, the period from about 3000 to 1150 BC. And I want to look at these aspects because they have a direct bearing on what we're going to study in detail. Why the Greeks? Well, we hear all the time that the roots of our Western tradition lie with the ancient Greeks. This is, of course, true. Think about what they created, pioneered, or formalized in the spheres of politics, of tragedy, comedy, poetry, pottery, sculpture, medicine, science, rhetoric. The list goes on and on. Their literary and philosophical legacies, for example, shaped for centuries the cultures of many civilizations, and they continue to do so. Where would we be without Homer, or Plato, or Aristotle, or Greek tragedy? Molière, for example, could not have written some of his comedies without Roman comedy, which in turn owed its origins to Greek New Comedy. President Clinton could not have given his 50th anniversary of D-Day speech, as he did in 1994 at the United States National Cemetery above Omaha Beach, without the sentiments expressed by Pericles, the Athenian leader, in his funeral oration of 430 BC. Nor, for that matter, could Lincoln have given the Gettysburg Address as he did without Pericles, or rather without Pericles' funeral oration. Although rhetoric has changed from what was really a performance in classical Athens to something that's interpreted and thought about today, the classical works are still exploited, and so indeed are the classical orators. Only recently I've seen references to Demosthenes, the great 4th century Athenian statesman and orator, referring Demosthenes to Indian politicians and even Senator Barack Obama in 2008. There are very good reasons for studying the ancient Greeks, so that we can learn more about the origins and development of our own culture and our civilization. But I want to do something different in our course, and I want to focus on three aspects of Greek history that are as much a mainstay of our tradition as they were of the Greek. And these three are democracy, law, and imperialism. In other words, what we're used to in our society today, how we live, what we have come to expect, and why. I believe these three topics, that's democracy, law, and imperialism, help to answer these questions. And moreover, and here's one of my heresies, and you're going to be hearing a lot of these in the course, so I may as well warn you now. I believe that these three inform us more about the Greeks than other aspects of their society, such as the artistic and the cultural. Now, these three will show us what we owe the Greeks, what things they actually did that for us play a hands-on role in our society today. And that's why we're going to discuss these three topics in a lot of detail. And I mean a lot of detail, probably more than you've ever come across before, but that's how I like to do things. And we're also going to be discussing them critically, which is another way I like to do things. For example, we're told the Athenians invented democracy. Okay, but how was it invented? Who invented it? Was it one person or a group of individuals? And how long did it take to develop into a mature system of government? Well, democracy was born out of civil war between nobles and non-nobles in Athens over such things as social and economic distress and lack of political rights for all but the aristocrats. Desperate to end this civil war, the ruling families, that's those aristocrats who are in charge of things, these ruling families of Athens gave absolute power to a man called Solon in 594 BC. He was supposed to fix it to end the civil war. Well, he introduced legislation that for the first time opened up political office to non-nobles, and he arranged for non-nobles to take part in political debate and make policy. And in doing so, he created democracy. Now, needless to say, many changes and additions were made to what Solon enacted over the years. And in 462 BC, an Athenian named Ephialtes introduced radical or direct democracy in Athens, where the people were sovereign in the state. And this remained the norm, apart from a couple of hiccups along the way, until the Macedonians abolished Athenian democracy in 322 BC, almost at the end of the 4th century. Solon then was the father of democracy and is often called that. But given his obvious importance to the Greeks and us, why is he not a household name like Hippocrates or Martin Luther, who also pioneered some new things that affected their times and beyond? I don't know the answer, but he was obviously important to Greeks because in later Greek tradition, Solon was one of the seven sages of Greece. Well, we look at Solon in lectures 7 to 8. In tandem with the creation of democracy was that of law, or at least the beginnings of a formal legal code. Again, what were the origins of the legal code? How did it develop? Was there such a thing as a father of Greek law? Well, yes, there was. The origins, again, that's the origins of law, again lie in civil strife. In the 620s BC, so about 30 years or so before Solon that we've just been chatting about, the tension we just mentioned had not yet escalated into civil war. The economic, social, and political tension was still running high. We don't have civil war yet. In an effort to end this tension, the ruling families of Athens elected a man called Dracon to codify the laws. Now, his major accomplishment was taking away the arbitrary dispensing of justice and making it more objective. What he did began a process that would lead to the classical legal system, and with it, other innovations such as trial by jury, arbitration, that we take for granted today. We might even note parallels with America, for example, where the arbitrary nature of justice in the old Wild West of shoot your opponent or hang that rustler first eventually grew into the more formalized code that we live by today. Dracon also gives us our word draconian, meaning anything severe or harsh. So we get an idea right away that he started off the system in some harsh manner. Well, yes, he did, because he made the penalty for every crime death. We look at what Dracon did in Lecture 5. Well, the Greeks may have had a brilliant civilization, but there were downsides to it, and to them, when it came to interference in other states. In other words, warfare and imperialism. Now, the era of the Persian Wars, it's from about 480 down to 479, 478 BC, though that era was a great one for Greeks, because for the most part, they were able to unite and defeat Xerxes, the great king of Persia, who'd planned on adding Greece to the Persian Empire. This was the Persian Wars, of course, that saw that famous Battle of Thermopylae with the 300 Spartans. Except, you know, there weren't just 300 Spartans, but you'll have to wait to the Persian Wars lecture to find out more about that. But in that defeat of the Persians, the seeds of Athenian imperialism were sown. The Athenians created a league, which soon turned into a 5th century empire that rode roughshod over the autonomy of their allies. The imperialistic policies of Athens's leaders, especially Pericles, would lead to the great Peloponnesian War of 431 to 404 against Sparta. And this was a civil war that ripped Greece apart. Now this war, the Peloponnesian War, has got nothing in common with the Persian Wars. These were fought against a common foe, for freedom and autonomy, something the Greeks believed in and would die for. But in the Peloponnesian War, the later one between Athens and Sparta, we see the influence of leaders steering states to war for their own agendas. We can think of parallels today, and I'll let you make them. But the twist is that today we talk of a common foe who is foreign, whereas Greeks saw other Greeks in their history and in the Peloponnesian War often as their enemy. So our course traces the origins and developments of democracy, law, and imperialism. It examines their workings against the backdrop of Greek history and society, and I hope you find this interesting, it compares and contrasts ancient practices with our contemporary world. Now, I hope I've whetted your appetite from what I've been saying so far. My aim by the time we finish our course is that you'll have learned a lot of new stuff about the Greeks, and with any luck, you'll have rethought some of your views on the Greeks that you might have had earlier. I'm always in favour of rethinking views. Now, I keep talking about the Greeks as a whole, and Greeks, of course, are found all over the place, not only on the mainland, but also far beyond there, Italy and Sicily, southern France, the Aegean Islands, Thrace, Crete, Cyprus, the Hellespont, the Black Sea, Asia Minor. Again, another list that goes on and on. For the purpose of our course, we have to focus exclusively on the mainland, and even then, for the most part, on Athens. Well, we know there were many cities throughout the Mediterranean, and archaeology shows that they were wealthy and cultured, but we know next to nothing about what went on in them. Now, this is because little or no literary sources have survived, either from them or written about them. You see the ruins of a temple, that tells you it was a temple. You look at the style of the temple, you know what the style was. But that doesn't tell you about the history or society of that place. And when we're bereft of this sort of information, we're in the dark. A temple just becomes then a bunch of stones. Almost all of our literary source material comes from Athens. This is perhaps because it was the major intellectual and cultural centre in the Greek world. It was the most important imperial power in the classical period. And perhaps because so many new aspects of society came into being there. And as a result, more writers wrote about it than anywhere else in Greece. And that's why we focus on Athens. And just think about that. In a city that had a population of, oh, who knows, it's controversial, 75,000 to maybe 125,000, 150,000, so perhaps the size of a largest Midwest town, all of this vast intellectual output, you know, came from there. And I just don't know why it's just from there and not other places. But because it's from there, and because our material tells us about Athens, we have to focus on that in our course. We're going to be dealing with the archaic and classical periods of Greek history. Now, this is a time span from the middle of the 8th century BC to 323 BC. The archaic period begins in about 750 BC with what's called the 8th century Renaissance, and it runs to the end of the Persian Wars in 478. And that's the subject of lectures 2 to 21. It's called the Archaic period because in contrast to the period before it, the so-called Dark Ages, new things start to happen in it, in the Archaic period that is, such as advances in pottery styles, the first Olympic Games, the Greek alphabet comes into being, and colonies are established all over the place, as far afield as the Black Sea and the Western Mediterranean. But especially for us, in the Archaic period, we have the origins of democracy and law. Now, the Classical period runs from the end of the Persian Wars in 478 to the death of Alexander the Great in 323. It's distinguished from this earlier period because the Classical takes up the innovations of the Archaic period and brings them to fruition. Artistically and culturally, this is the golden age of Greek civilization. And for our purposes, it's also the time when the democratic and legal systems are fully developed. Militarily, the Persian Wars that end the Archaic period herald the dawn of a new era, because they are Greece's coming of age as a military power. And it's this military power that's polarized in the oppressive empires of Athens and Sparta during the 5th and 4th centuries BC, until we get the rise of Macedonia under Philip II and Alexander III, the so-called Great. The Classical period is the subject of lectures 22 to 47. There are more lectures on it because there's a lot more going on. Let me now turn to the arrangement of lectures. Given that the Archaic and Classical periods fall so neatly into two, and that the origins of things in the first lead to their development and maturity in the second, I've organized the contents of our course chronologically and thematically by these two periods. So, for example, since the 8th century Renaissance officially kicks off the Archaic period, it makes sense to devote a lecture to it, and that's what we'll be talking about in our next lecture. We'll cover the origins and early developments of democracy and law, which one could argue characterize the Archaic period, in lectures 3 to 14. And it's in this period that we see the unique development of one place that I call the odd man out state of Greece, and that's Sparta. Now, we can't study Athenian imperialism in any detail without knowing about Sparta. So lectures 14 to 17 discuss the rise of Sparta to influence in Greece and what made it different from other states. We're now at the cusp of the classical period, and the next set of lectures, 18 to 21, will get us there. They deal with the Persian Wars, the transition period, as I've already explained. So we're now at a stage where democracy is developing in Greece. People are getting used to it. The legal system is also developing. But all these things are still at an infancy stage. They will grow up and mature in the classical period, though, as we'll see. Unfortunately, tensions between states, especially Athens and Sparta, were also arising in the Archaic period. And they too will grow up, or rather escalate, in the classical period. In lectures 22 to 33, we will discuss the rise of Athenian imperialism, the Great Peloponnesian War, and then some radical political developments in Athens. The 4th century is going to be a dramatic one for the Greeks with the rise of Macedonia. Greek history will never be the same again. The Athenians bounce back from their defeat in the Peloponnesian War. Oh, I gave the end away. Never mind. They lose. But they do bounce back, and they put together a 4th century empire. And it's in this period that the judicial system comes to maturity, which we discuss in detail in lectures 34 to 38. The Athenians invented things like trial by jury, arbitration, third-party intervention. But I'm also going to argue, here's another heresy, that we have the origins of the modern attorney in their system as well. Our final set of lectures, numbers 40 to 47, deal with 4th century Macedonian imperialism, first under Philip II, who ended Greek autonomy, and then under his son, Alexander the Great. So-called great, as you'll find, I call him. Our final lecture, number 48, looks at Greek history after our period and asks questions that our courses raised and what we can take away from it. So, in a nutshell, that's what it's all about. Now I move to the second part of my lecture, which is meant to set the scene for the Archaic period by looking at the origins of some of the things that the Greeks of the mainland adapted over the centuries. Well before the 8th century BC, the start of the Archaic period, the Greeks had a flourishing civilization which modern scholars call the Bronze Age. This is the age of mythology and the Trojan War. This Bronze Age lasted from roughly 3000 to 1150 BC, and it's called the Bronze Age because bronze was commonly used for making weapons, tools, domestic utensils, and so on. Now, there are many important Bronze Age places throughout the Greek world, from the mainland to Crete, the Minoans, to the islands of the Cyclades, to Cyprus and the Near East. You could have an entire course just on the Bronze Age, and I can't begin to do it justice if I had the whole 30 minutes of this lecture. However, because we're focusing on the Greek mainland in our course, what I want to do now is talk only about those aspects of the Bronze Age mainland that are most useful for us to know about. Because once we get a handle on these, we can see how they were taken up in the Archaic period. Now, the Bronze Age civilization of the Greek mainland is called the Mycenaean, and it was called that after Mycenae, the city that was ruled by Agamemnon. This was the Agamemnon who led the Greeks against Troy in about 1184 to retrieve Helen, his brother Menelaus's wife. If you remember, Helen had been kidnapped by Paris, the son of Priam of Troy, and the Greeks wanted her back. And so began the famous 10-year Trojan War, and also the origins of the phrase, the face that launched 1,000 ships. Because the Greek army that Agamemnon headed was so large, it was like 1,000 ships, and it was to get Helen back. It was the last year of this war that Homer would sing about in his Iliad. And it was about the return of the hero Odysseus from Troy that he would sing about in his Odyssey. Now, throughout the Bronze Age period, monarchic power was normal. Bronze Age Greece was ruled by kings. Mycenaean Greece, like the other areas of the Bronze Age period, was comprised of a number of palaces, each headed by a king with a bureaucracy. The king was responsible for the political, military, economic, and religious life at his palace, and hence he was in charge of the area that it dominated. Now, that doesn't necessarily make him the chief priest or the commander of the troops, as other men in the court hierarchy seem to have that sort of function. But because of his position, he may have been something akin to a titular figurehead, something similar to the president of the USA today, who is commander-in-chief of the troops, ex officio. In other words, the king was, by his rank, commander-in-chief, and perhaps had some overall religious function in the state, but there were others in the hierarchy who actually did the nuts and bolts that were part of that job. Now, each palace was autonomous, and each palace was the administrative and economic center of the area in which it was situated. In other words, it was the capital of the towns and villages that existed around it. Now, archaeological evidence shows that the Mycenaean palaces were very large and that the people had great artistic ability and wealth. Mycenaean society was also very warlike. That makes it different from other Bronze Age societies, for example, Minoan Crete. And we know that Mycenaean society was warlike because of the grave goods that have been found, arms and armor, plus the fact that Mycenaean palaces had very thick fortification walls and they were strategically built on top of hills in case of attack. In other words, a palace site was determined by the height of a hill to give the best views. Hence, a high fortified citadel becomes most important. That's why Athens was the most important city in Attica, the area in which it was located, during the Bronze Age and afterwards, as we'll see. Although in the Bronze Age, by the way, Athens wasn't nearly on a par with the big palace centres at Mycenae or Pylos down in the southwest Peloponnese. Now, the Mycenaean civilization ended in about 1150. The reason why it ended is unknown. But explanations include attack from an outside people, perhaps these so-called Dorians, who invaded from the north and penetrated as far south as the Peloponnese. The Spartans were Dorians. Another explanation is that there may have been some sort of civil uprising that overthrew the monarchy, and that as a result, several noble families came to exercise political power. The bottom line is that the Mycenaean Age ended in a fight because we have preserved from many palaces Linear B tablets. Now, these tablets have inscribed on them all sorts of everyday information, numbers of livestock, a person's offering to the gods, lists of personnel, and they're in what's called Linear B, which is an early form of the Greek language. The common practice was to use clay tablets to write things on them and later to wipe whatever it was off and reuse these tablets, just as today we might have a board and marker pen in the kitchen to write grocery lists. They were not meant to be baked, which would set the information on them for good. But they've survived from this period because the palaces were destroyed by fire, so these tablets got baked in the fires. And that's a sign that the palaces met with a violent end. It won't be the first time, as we'll see, that an existing regime is toppled by force and a new order comes into being, usually the result of a civil uprising. The palace centres of the Bronze Age will spawn the rise of some cities as the chief ones in their areas. In other words, the polis system that we'll talk about in our next lecture, where Greece became a number of independent city-states, a polis. Linear B will develop into classical Greek, but we're not going to talk an awful lot about the Greek language because I'm really not a Bronze Age linguist. We might say that these factors, the high citadels, the way that the palace centres spawn the polis, the city-states of Greece, we might say that these factors are the most important legacies of the Bronze Age, more than pottery designs or artwork, more than expanding trade routes, because it's these things that are adopted and adapted by the later Greeks, especially the exercise of power by ruling families. Now, with the end of Mycenaean civilization, the period known as the Dark Ages began. And this will last till the start of the Archaic period in 750. It's called the Dark Ages, very appropriately, because we don't know a lot about what went on in this time. There were advances in pottery. There was a gradual increase in population. And power was in the hands of aristocratic families. So much of what became normal in Archaic and Classical Greek society came into being from the end of the Bronze Age, tracking through the Dark Age period. Much that becomes normal in later Greek history comes into being. So also, unfortunately, does the agrarian and social distress from the oligarchic rule that lay at the heart of the democratic and judicial advances of the Archaic period. In other words, what also is happening during the Dark Ages is that the ruling families are getting more and more oppressive, and that the people as a whole are finding it harder and harder to eke an existence. That's a scenario for civil war, because the ruling families don't care about the mass of the people. In summary then, we've talked about some aspects of Mycenaean civilization that find their way, with changes, into the Archaic period. We've needed to trace these aspects to show that later Greek history didn't suddenly spring up fully formed like Athena from Zeus's brow, but it borrowed from what went on before it. In the next lecture, we'll discuss some of the things that we know about from the Dark Ages, and then turn to the 8th century Renaissance, the start of the Archaic period proper, when history comes alive again and society starts to develop unlike ever before. But if we're dealing with new material and new things happening, if this Archaic period is marked by unprecedented novelty and achievement, if in it we have the origins of democracy and law that we live by today, why is it called Archaic? Well, you'll have to wait till the next lecture for the answer to that. Thank you very much.